Good evening and welcome. There are many thanks this evening, first and foremost, of course, to Hagaon Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, who is with us. I have many opportunities to read his Sfarim, a few opportunities to listen to him in person, and I'll come back to introducing him in a couple of minutes. I want to give special thanks also to Rav Shai Schechter, the Mr. Woodmere, who really connected us and enabled us to have this evening, and Avi Freilich, who made all the connections with us. Additionally, we'd like to thank the sponsors for the evening, Dr. Jerry and Chaim Zatz, and memory of their parents, Rabbi Zalta Schmidman, Alta Chava, Malka Bas Avram Yosef, Allah Shalom, Rabbi Shmuel Schmidman, my Rabbi from high school, Shmuel, Rabbi Mikhail, Zachon Lebracha, Dr. Chaim Zatz, Chaim Alta Ben Yecheskel, also sponsored by Dr. Zavion Freilich, memory of their parents, Dorothy Weinstein, Dvorah, Slava Bas Yitzchak, Allah Shalom, Rabbi Isaac Freilich, Rabbi Yitzchak Dov, and Avram Yaakov, Allah Shalom, and Leon Weinstein, Yehuda Leib, Ben Yitzchak, and also sponsored by Dr. Benjamin Arisfeld, Dr. Yoel Yisrael Gardowski, Avraham Sharon Blumenthal, and John and Dr. Marion Gessler Kramer, and also special thanks to Rabbi Taub for participating in the Unusual Holocaust Special Fund and our own also special fund to Mix the States. The funds that were raised will be used to publish future Sfarim or republish Sfarim of Rav Weiss. If you're interested in participating, you can see me after, and Baruch Hashem, Rav Weiss has many, many Sfarim which need to be published, and we benefit from them greatly. Among the Sfarim, he has three sets of Tshuva from the Chasasha. The fourth one is, I understand, in preparation. And if you come to various shiurim, whether it's during the week or so on, over time, you have heard some of them transmitted. A few years ago, I remember on a Shavuos night, we talked about the Kedusha of the Kotel Plaza, which was one of the Tshuvas in the first Chelek. Rav Weiss is the based in Rosh Hashiva and Darkei Torah. He's the postdoc of Shari Tzedek Hospital. As I understand, also the postdoc for IDF and Mossad. I don't know what that means, but I will probably find out something about that. The bio says, beloved, highly respected. I think it's an understatement to say that he is beloved and highly respected because of who he is and what he is. He has a tremendous wealth of knowledge which he shares with everyone. He this morning had a wonderful introduction, which was much longer than mine, and he got up and said he thanked the introducer for the exaggerated introduction. There's no exaggerations here, and he may again say exaggerated, but we're really very much privileged. He is not only respected in the we'll say high Torah community, but in all the communities. People go and ask him questions of all sorts, whether it's medical, ethical, IDF, and so on, but also respected across the communities, Orthodox communities of Israel, non-Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, whatever terms you want to use, in Israel and around the world. It has been a long time since we had a posek who was so wide-ranging that he deals with everything. I just want to make one last comment, that's the following. People come to rabbis with questions, and the rabbis always need people to go to for answers because we don't have all the answers, and we go to people like Rav Weiss. Rav Weiss is accessible to us also. We don't necessarily call them to throw up all the questions. But one of the things which is very clear to me about Rav Weiss as standing out among the poskim who are real poskim is they have an understanding of the entire range of halacha. It's not this topic or that topic. It's all topics. And therefore, whatever topic Rav Weiss could be asked to speak about, he can speak about. And that's why he can speak about the specific topics we're going to speak about this evening. There will be opportunities for questions answered afterwards. We will distribute cards to those who want to ask questions, write them down, and we'll take questions at the end. A great pleasure to choose from us.
So I'm happy to be here with you tonight, and I thank this was not planned. I thank Rabbi Hochberg for hosting this evening, and I profoundly thank my recent friend, Dr. Freilich, whom I met just a year ago, I think. And I'm happy to be here this evening in this wonderful community. So I was asked to discuss Shilas from the IDF or the Mossad. So I am not the official rabbi and posek of the IDF, as you know, but I happen to know the chief rabbi of the IDF, the chief rabbi of the Mishtara, the new chief rabbi of the police force in Israel, the chief rabbi of the Mossad, who is Rabbi S. That is all. Or Harav Shin. That is all people know about him, but he does consult me on a steady basis. So many of the questions involving the security establishment in Israel ultimately come to my desk and demand my opinion or my attitudes. So it is a unique challenge. And generally speaking, I many times say to my Talmidim that our generation really needs Gedolim of the caliber of the Ramban and the Rashba. Because we have so many shilas, shalosh arum avoteinu, so many shilas to which we barely find any reference or any source in our sources. The advance of science, of technology, poses tremendous challenges for poskim in our generation. And sometimes the only tools we have to decide is svara, and the ability, as Chazal say, ledamot milta la milta, comparing one sugya with the other and using our sound judgment and svara yeshora. So we really need gedolim of the caliber of the great Rishonim, and we don't have them. So we need to rise to the challenge and try to do our best to solve the grave and very unique shilas, especially when we're dealing with security in the state of Israel. Because we find very, very few sources. It's been 2,000 years, probably since the days of David HaMelech, that there was a sovereign Jewish state. And we don't have Shalas HaTshuvas Divrei David from David HaMelech, or from any of his Rabbonim. And we have very few sources trying to deal with the questions, how would we halachically run a modern Jewish state? So these questions involve primarily the security establishment, but also the health establishment, running hospitals and the modern day and age, and we really have very few sources to draw upon. So 70 years ago, we find an interesting tshuva in the Tzitz Eliezer, which he discusses with the Pesh Pesach Frank the Har Tzvi. And the Tzitz Eliezer suggests that the police on Shabbos use mules. Instead of driving cars and vehicles, maybe they should use mules, animals, donkeys. I don't think that would be a very reasonable proposition today, having the police force in Israel using mules, or the IDF maybe charging into battle on mules. So we really have very difficult halachic issues. So we do find in Shabbos a few Tesomid Beis, two halachas. And the Rishonim deal, are these two halachas associated? Are they two sides of the same coin? Ein mafligim besvino, gimel yomim lifnei Shabbos, ein tzorin al huayorois, gimel yomim lifnei Shabbos. So the Mishnah deals with two different situations. One should not embark on a sea journey 3 days before Shabbos, but if he did embark on that journey before then, he is entitled to be on his ship or boat or tanker or aircraft carrier or whatever it is, Shabbos as well. And we should not lay siege to a city 3 days before Shabbos, but if we are already engaged in battle, then war could go on. And we don't have to silence the guns when Shabbos comes. And Beis Shammai says, Adridita afilu v'Shabbos. So how do we define these two halachas? Three different opinions. The Rambam, and the Rif, the Rambam Perek Lamed of Hilchos Shabbos, the Rambam is understanding that both halachas are two sides of the same coin. And the reasoning is all about Oinig Shabbos. So when you have young soldiers and their first introduction to the chaos of a battlefield is very disturbing, and sometimes it is defined as shell shock, it is a traumatic experience. So the Rambam writes, we should try to avoid that experience on Shabbos. It's all about Oinig Shabbos. And the same when you embark on a sea journey, and what we define as seasickness sometimes is disturbing. So the opinion and the interpretation of the Rif and the Rambam, all about Oinig Shabbos. Rabbeinu Zerachia HaLevi, the Baal HaMor, maintains that both situations are related, and the reasoning of both halachos is Nera Kimasna Lechalel Esa Shabbos. So Chilul Shabbos in those both situations would be justified by Pikuach Nefesh. Yes, there are things you need to do on a ship that involve Chilul Shabbos, but if you don't do them, you might be endangering people that are on this sea vessel. The same regarding combat, the same regarding being engaged in war. But if we could prevent the situation and try to postpone it till after Shabbos, that is what we should do. The Me'iri interprets halacha number one in accordance to the Rambam and halacha number two in accordance to the Baal HaMor. So those are the three basic opinions. So Beis Shammai says that one is entitled, Israel is entitled to wage war on Shabbos because the Pasuk says, Adridito afilu b'Shabbos. What are we dealing with? Are we dealing with a Melchemes Mitzvah? Then probably it would be defined as Pikuach Nefesh, which overrides Shabbos. And if there is no essential need to wage war on Shabbos, why would it be justified? So there are two different basic interpretations. One is the Radbaz. The Radbaz in Hilchos Shabbos and in Hilchos Malachim as well. Perek Ches of Hilchos Malachim and Perek Beis in Hilchos Shabbos, the Radbaz says, well, we are dealing with a basic Pikuach Nefesh situation. But the definition of Pikuach Nefesh in war is different than the definition of Pikuach Nefesh in peacetime. And when we are engaged in battle, we broaden the definition and the scope of Pikuach Nefesh. The ultimate success in battle would always be defined as Pikuach Nefesh to override Shabbos, and that is what Beis Shammai learns from the Posuk, Adridito Afilo B'Shabbos. The Rivash, who was in the same generation of the Radbaz, going back more than 500 years, almost 600 years, in Tshuva Sarivash Simen Kufalaf, we find that the understanding of the Rivash, Rabbi Yitzchok Bar Sheshet, is that the ultimate and successful execution of war in itself overrides Shabbos. And it is not an extension of the halacha of Pikuach Nefesh. The Svas Emes, who was one of the later Achronim, and what is unique about the Derech HaLimud of the Svas Emes, it's quite obvious that he learned Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, and he wrote his comments. In most cases, he wasn't aware of the other Rishonim or the opinions of the Rambam. But it is amazing to see how often and how common it is that the Svas Emes writes what we find on the spot in Ramban, in Rashbo, in Ran, and in Ritva, because he really was a sage. And the Svas Emes on his own writes that probably the proper interpretation of Beis Shammai would be, yes, the successful execution of warfare or battle overrides Shabbos, not based on the broader principle of Pikuach Nefesh. Melchemes Mitzvah, and even Melchemes Rishus, when need be, overrides Shabbos. So going back 70 years in the first days in the birth of the modern state of Israel, this was a major discussion between Poskim regarding the security and of the state of Israel regarding Hilchos Shabbos. One of the common questions in dealing with questions and dilemmas of the IDF regarding Shabbos is the importance of executing orders. And it is the ethos of every modern army in the world, the hierarchy and the proper execution of orders. So sometimes the individual would feel we could cut corners and we have the liberty to decide what would be justified and what would not be justified on Shabbos. But sometimes that could cause terrible tragedy. So a situation I was made aware of was there is an unbelievable array of surveillance cameras covering almost all the Arab villages in Judea, in the Shomron, and there's a huge contingent, a unit in the IDF, mostly female soldiers, monitoring the screens 24 hours a day and just being aware of what's happening in those towns and on cities. And there was an incident in which seemed to be totally innocent, an accident involving a vehicle, a truck, that crashed into a telephone pole and the pole fell down. And the soldier monitoring the screen did not feel that it's justified to notify her superiors on Shabbos, just letting them know and sending them a message would involve Chilul Shabbos, and that was not done. 3 days later, an Israeli patrol was attacked at that very same spot, and two soldiers were killed. And what became known later is that the Palestinians had some either knowledge or they thought there might be some surveillance camera on that pole, and they intentionally posed that accident to bring that pole down, and there was a surveillance camera up there. And the girl monitoring the screen would have no way to know. So it seemed to be a purely civilian accident, and she felt no need to notify the higher echelons of this episode, and ultimately that caused the death of two young Israeli soldiers, which proves that you need to execute orders and you need to do as told, and not always could you rely on your own personal judgment to know or decide what might be essential and what not, what might be considered pikuach nefesh and what not be considered pikuach nefesh. Another basic question regarding not only the security establishment, but hospitals as well, is how do we define pikuach nefesh on a larger scale? So just to give you an example, there are two ways to turn a turret on a tank. And I don't know whether there are many military men in this audience, but the cannon or the gun is positioned on the turret. And the only way to turn the gun from one side to the other, the cannon, is by turning the turret. So there is a hydraulic system, which is extremely fast and effective. And in combat, that is the system that is used. But there also is a manual system, which takes a far longer time, and it is totally inefficient on the battlefield. And there's a very clear order for people sit in a tank, in most modern tanks. Once upon a time we had 6 or 7, but modern tanks there are 4 soldiers. And if any of them just wants to move in the tank, getting up, sitting down, moving from one position to the other, the hydraulic system needs to be turned off. Because if a soldier just stands up and at that very moment the turret would be repositioned. He might as have his head totally being dismembered and destroyed. So that is a very harsh order. So what happens when four Frum soldiers are in a tank? Turning off the hydraulic system or turning it on would involve closing electrical circuits, which would be considered chilul Shabbos. So these four young boys are sitting in the tank, and they speak to each other, and one of them wants to leave the tank for any reason. And he tells his friends, you know, I'm getting up, I'm leaving the tank, so just everybody be careful, don't use the system and don't reposition or turn the turret. Would that be justified? Would it be justified to be mechallel Shabbos just to follow orders if there is no real need? So sooner or later, if we disregard orders and we just ignore them, we're quite sure that sooner or later someone will get hurt. Sooner or later somebody might pay with his life for disregarding orders. Would that be considered pikuach nefesh, and would that justify turning on and turning off electrical systems? So when pikuach nefesh might be down the line, not immediate, not right here and now, but if we disregard orders, we are quite aware that sooner or later somebody might be gravely hurt, someone's life might be destroyed. Would that be considered pikuach nefesh? So I recently wrote a tshuva in a different context, not involving the IDF, but involving Hatzola in South Africa, in Johannesburg. So there are new regulations in Johannesburg that you cannot be a paramedic and you cannot be a member of Hatzola unless you serve 2 weeks in a public medical facility. Now, in public medical facilities in South Africa, you would never find a Jewish person. South Africa has one of the highest AIDS rates in the world, one of the highest in Africa, and Jewish people would never go into a public facility. There are private hospitals, many private facilities, and probably that is where you'll find the Jews. So, and the authorities were not forthcoming. In no way did they agree to exempt the young Jewish people from working on Shabbos. They demanded 2 weeks, nonstop, including Shabbos. And the question was, would it be permissible to have those young Jewish volunteers being mechallel Shabbos in a facility in which there is no chance at all that they're treating their brethren? Because if we do not find a heter, then 3 or 4 years down the road, there will be no Hatzola in Johannesburg. And Hatzola in Joburg probably is more important than Hatzola in Jamaica, whatever it is. What's the town called? States. Jamaica States. We're a bit far from Jamaica, but probably Hatzola there is more essential than it is in New York or in Yerushalayim or in many other Jewish communities in the world, because the general public services, health services, are quite bad in that part of the world. So would we justify Chilul Shabbos right here and now, just to make sure that 3 years down the road we will have volunteers that could save Jewish lives? And I brought many sources that pikuach nefesh, even though it's not immediate, might be down the road, indirect, still would be defined and considered pikuach nefesh. So I brought about 6 or 7 sources. Maybe one of the more interesting ones is the Bisyosef and Simen Kufaintes and Yoredeya. So the Gemara says in Perek Meruba, in Mesechet Bavakama, Hitiru lebeis Rebbe lesaper kumi. So the family of the Nosi of Rabbeinu HaKadosh had a special permit to have a certain hairstyle, haircut, which was non-Jewish. And according to the Bisyosef, we are dealing with the Nisi Dioraisav, Bechu Koiseyem Lo Teilechu. It was the non-Jewish clergy that had that special hairstyle. And Chachomim gave a special permit to the family of the Nasi to do the same. to have them acceptable, presentable to the non-Jewish royalty. And the Bais Yosef wonders if it would be considered in a Sidiuraisa, what would be the basis of leniency? And the Bais Yosef explains, sometimes we need the right people in the right places. Sometimes we need to deal with Pidyon Shavuyim or other Pikuach Nefesh situations. And that would justify violating the Sidiuraisa of Bechukoseim Lo Tolech. So we don't know how many individuals they were. But we could assume tens, maybe 100, maybe more. And if you need a special haircut to be presentable, probably they didn't have that haircut like Ger HaChassidim twice a year, Erev Pesach and Erev Rosh Hashanah. So probably they had their hair done once in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month. Hundreds of people violated the Nisa D'Uraisa on a steady basis because sometimes we need them to engage in Pidyon Shavuyim. So this would be one of the relevant sources from which we learn that Pikuach Nefesh is Pikuach Nefesh. It might not be right here and now. It might be sometime down the road, but it still would be defined as Pikuach Nefesh. It needs to be relevant. It needs to be not too far-fetched. On the other hand, the Noi Debut, the Paskins, and the Chassam Sofer follows in his footsteps that dissecting one's body for medical research would not be defined as Pikuach Nefesh. So we need to draw the line somewhere between Pikuach Nefesh that might be far-fetched and remote, and that would not be considered Pikuach Nefesh, other situations which might not be immediate, but they are very relevant and very real and very substantive, and those would be defined as Pikuach Nefesh. So my clear ruling was, following orders in the army would be defined as Pikuach Nefesh. So right here and now, when those four young Frum soldiers are sitting in the tank, obviously, if they cooperate with each other, everything will be fine. But if we give a psak that you could disregard orders somewhere, sometime, people will be hurt. Children might lose their lives, and therefore adhering to the psukim would be defined as pikuach nefesh. The big challenge is there are so many different things that are indirect pikuach nefesh. And this is unique not only to the IDF. Having proper police patrols on Shabbos. So the police patrol our communities and not only respond to definitive calls. And in modern society, it goes without saying that it is important. It gives a sense of security to the community. It is a certain deterrent for the non-positive elements that are part of every society. Would that be defined as pikuach nefesh? So, if everything the security operation, enterprise, establishment in Israel would be totally adherent to aloha, would we allow police officers to drive their cars just for the sense of security of the greater community? Would that be defined as pikuach nefesh? So Rav Eldenberg suggested Shabbos they should use mules and donkeys. As I said, I don't think that would be a sensible or reasonable proposition in our modern day and age. So if it would be within our power, we would do everything to devise different options of shinui, just to try to steer clear from a malacha d'oraisa. So, well, we are living in an age of unbelievable leaps and bounds in technology. So maybe electrical cars would be preferable to the ones that use gas, because, yes, we do assume that closing an electrical circuit would be defined as a malacha d'oraisa, but on the other hand, one cannot totally disregard the opinions of the great Poiskim before the Chazon Ish, the Beis Yitzchak and the Marsham, who felt that closing an electrical circuit would be a derabbanan of Meilid. So, lechatchila, yes, we should be choshesh that we're dealing with a deoraisa. But if we have to choose between a vehicle that uses burns gas and one that is operated by an electrical battery, I would suggest using electricity and not burning gas. So, if it would be within our power, we would need to devise and apply technology to be able to do whatever we need to do, trying to steer clear from Halachas D'oraisa. But it is not totally within our power, and it is not always relevant. So I do feel that when you're dealing with a public, and not with the yochid, not with the individual, but with the security of the broader public or the security of state, then our total approach to Pikuah Nefesh would be a different one. And this is also based on a sugi in Shabbos Daf Mem Beis, when we learn a gecheles shel matches, which is b'reshus harabim, would be defined as a potential pikuach nefesh situation. So we're not dealing directly with death, but actually with nezek l'rabim. But the Ramban and the Rashba do seem to interpret any cheshash of nezek l'rabim would be defined as pikuach nefesh, because when you're dealing with the many, not with a few, not with individuals, we need to be more careful about potential pikuach nefesh situations. So without going into many specific details, these are some of the broader dilemmas that are part of what we do on an ongoing basis regarding the security establishment in Israel, whether it's the police or the army or the Mossad. And in the Mossad, there are more specific questions which are unique to intelligence and not to other branches of security. So it is an amazing fact, but approximately between 20% and 25% of field agents in the Mossad today are observant, are from, and that's an amazing number, which is relatively recent. Wasn't the situation many years ago. And those people really want to adhere to Aloha, and they have some very, very unique questions. Just what comes to mind was one Shaila I dealt with, a field agent, and he serves out there in the most dangerous places, and he could have nothing that will identify him as being Jewish, not even on his computer. So he cannot have Oitzer HaChochma on his computer, or the Rambam on my computer. I have almost Kol HaTorah Kula, the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, and goes without saying, I have most of the Minchas Oshos on my computer. So serving where he serves, he can have no tefillin, no tzitzis, not even a sitter on his computer, nothing that might disclose his true identity. So when mission is accomplished, what is the greed that he has to rush back home? Just chaperein tefillin before the shkia or before the tzeis. Or if he is serving anywhere in the broader Middle East or in Europe or wherever he is, is he entitled to take another few hours just to go and get a cup of tea somewhere and air out his head before coming back home? That is just one of the myriad of a million questions that are unique to field agents of the Mossad and other branches of Israeli intelligence. So I did discuss with you some of the challenges we have, which are unique to security in the state of Israel. And as I said in my opening comment, many of these shailas, we have very few sources, because probably the shailas David HaMelech had to deal with 2,500 years ago in his army are different than the ones we need to deal with today. And throughout the entire period of the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Rambam, the Rishonim, we did not have the challenge of running a Jewish state in accordance to halacha. So this is one of the greatest challenges of our time, of our generation, and we need to do our best to try to rise to the challenge. And, you know, I daven every day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give me the kayak to fulfill my duty in a humble way with whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me to fulfill that duty.
Thank you very much. I'm going to pass that card if you want to ask the questions. Just take the card as we go back and write it down, and I'll come back and...
Filling out those cards might be time consuming. If anybody wants to take the opportunity before filling out those cards.
What's the answer to the question you just raised?
The last one I just discussed?
Yeah.
Yes. I did pass him that he should try to come home as soon as possible, but it's not a clear halachic chiyuv to come home on the same day to perform mitzvahs tefillin. When he is out of the vicinity of danger, wherever he is, you know, he could, coming into a friendly country, he could be more free according to their rules and regulations, which I am not proud of, and he could always come into a shul wherever he is if he is out of the danger zone, and if there is no reason to be concerned that he might be followed. But he is not mechuyev to rush home as soon as possible.
It's a sensitive question. I heard that a few years ago the Tzomet Institute wrote about this, but it has to do with the Mossad. Again, it's a sensitive question. There are times, and this could just be fiction, American fiction, that a female Mossad agent has to, or feels that if she utilizes some shemets of arayas, she could get information.
Yes, it is more myth than substance. And in these fascinating spy stories we have, but it is considered unethical and intelligence agencies in the free world do not do that. Maybe in the East they do, but it is not accepted practice in Israel, and to the best of my knowledge, neither is it in America. So, yes, sometimes there are somewhat, what I can say that a code of conduct of a female agent would be the same as in Beis Yaakov. Probably wouldn't be the same, but they don't cross limits and boundaries, and the Mossad does not expect female agents to go all the way to... that is not accepted practice.
Next, what is the Rosh's opinion of routine DNR orders? Routine DNR orders. Not
I am asked these questions very often, and I recommend people that are concerned with end-of-life issues to have a proxy they could rely on, whether it's a family member or a rav, not sign on a general DNR, because there are many situations in which it would be halachically important to resuscitate. And on the other hand, people have the right to be concerned about to what extent they will be kept alive in extreme situations. So I prefer having a proxy appointed, a person who is a Talmud Chacham, who you could trust that his judgment would be steeped and based on halacha, and not just sign a DNR statement, because that will be interpreted in a fashion in which many times it would not be halachically valid.
The Rebbe discussed the early case of Jewish fighters being slaughtered on Shabbos and the resultant heter to engage in self-defense and chilul Shabbos for the first time.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
That's my question.
What is it?
In we do have an early source, I don't remember the details, maybe the rubber's familiar with it, that first allowed for activity that would otherwise be prohibited because these Jewish people refused to fight back because of a Shabbos.
The Book of the Maccabees.
I think we have the story told in early sources, but halachically that would be no question at all. I mean, as I mentioned before, we even could initiate battle on Shabbos, and that seems to be a machlokes between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. So in Yerushalmi, we have two sources dealing with the drash, ad ridit afilu b'Shabbos. So in Bavli, it appears Shabbos daf yud tes, in Yerushalmi, it appears in Shabbos daf yud gimel. And according to the Bavli, if we are engaged in combat, we could continue in Shabbos. According to Yerushalmi, we could even initiate the beginning of hostilities on Shabbos. But to respond, definitely would be beyond question, would be permissible. So if there are any early sources that is what Israeli fighters did, that definitely would not be in accordance to halacha.
What is the halacha opinion regarding torture of terrorists to obtain life-saving intelligence?
I don't remember the exact terminology. I think in Israel it was defined as lachatz fisi matun, which would be loosely translated as moderate physical pressure. I think between military men there is some degree of discussion whether that methodology would be most efficient in achieving intelligence. But I think that anything that would really be needed and essential to gain information would be halachically permissible. Anything that is needed to be done to achieve information that might save innocent lives would be halachically permissible.
A few questions on the same issue. Is it appropriate for women to serve in combat units? If not, what is an appropriate job for women in the IDF?
I definitely think it would be most appropriate for a woman to light the Shabbos candles in the IDF. And and probably we would have some other jobs for them as well. I don't think that women should serve in combat units. Chazal speak about Melchemes Mitzvah. And Chazal say that the Chosin is Yoitzim Mechepose and the Kala Yoitzis Mechedra and the Rishonim already deal with the question, what does the Kala have to do in time of war? And the Rishonim say, well, the women have to participate in their way, not on the front lines of combat units, but in many different things that females could do in either in the back units or at home to enhance and to participate in war efforts.
What does the Rav think about the status of Hasbara and the function of the spokesperson of the IDF regards to Pikuach Nefesh?
I did not understand the question.
Okay, we'll go to the next question. I'm not sure what's saying. Okay, if we treated deferred Pikuach Nefesh as Lefanegu, can Cohen even go to medical school?
I think it's very problematic if a Kohen needs to engage directly in anatomy. I was told that today there are possibilities that Kohenim could go to medical school without needing to dissect bodies or directly expose themselves to Tumas Kohenim. If that is true, I think it's a blessing. If Kohenim need to deal with cadavers, especially in Israel, when most of the bodies are Jewish donors that are metameh ba'oil, and even non-Jewish bodies are metameh b'maga, that is extremely problematic. Because I was recently asked in public, is it true, said in your name, that if a person is not in kollel, then he should become a doctor? So that is a very broad statement. So I did recall that a young person told me that he's in medical school, and he asked me, am I doing the right thing? So I said, if you can be a Marbit Steiter, second best choice would be being a doctor. So I was quoted as giving a general psak that everybody that's not in Kollel should go to medical school. And I never intended to give that as a general psak. But I do think it is a most noble profession, goes without saying. I mean, doctors have the opportunity of caring for the ill and the desperate on a day-to-day basis. And I really think that besides being Marbit Steiter, it's probably the greatest profession one could imagine. But nevertheless, Efshel HaMitzvah Yoseh L'Dei Acherim, and I don't think there would be any heter for a Kayin going to medical school and exposing himself to Isurim and to Tumas Kehanim, because at a later stage he will be engaged in Pikuach Nefesh, because in the modern world we can never say that we need you. You know, Uncle Sam wants you, but the Torah doesn't necessarily want you to be a doctor when there are many others out there that might be just as good as you might be. So I don't think there would be any heter for a kohen to expose himself to Tumas Kehanim, because at a later stage he might be engaged in Atzolos Nefoshes.
These are three related questions, at least in my mind they're related. Number one, targeted assassination by Mossad when there's no longer a risk from a particular terrorist. Is it permissible for Mossad to risk the lives of their agents in order to exact punishment of a terrorist who committed murder but is no longer a threat to the state of Israel or its citizens? I'm not sure that's a possibility. And the third is that allowed to be permitted for soldiers to put their lives in danger to retrieve the body of a deceased comrade and enemies?
Yes. These are operational considerations. And I think in many endeavors and in many areas, Poskim should not blindly. We do have the right, and we are entitled to question and to defer. But broadly speaking, we are to respect the opinions of professionals in their respective fields. And many senior commanders feel that it is imperative and of extreme importance to take care of soldiers that were killed on the battlefield, and that boosts morale, and it would have a devastating effect on the morale of soldiers that are putting their lives on the line if we would not do our utmost to take their fallen comrades back home. And that would be considered a pikuach nefesh consideration. So if that is the professional opinion of senior commanders, yes, I think that should be taken as a given, even though I once again say any person in a position in which he needs to rule and paskin is entitled to ask questions and to defer and apply his own feelings and common sense, but ultimately I think we are to respect the professional opinions. Killing terrorists that no longer pose a threat. I know it would be very popular in most of our communities to say, yes, we should kill them, they don't deserve to live, but I think that would be a grave mistake. And I think much of our moral authority throughout the years was based on the fact that the world knew that an Israeli soldier would not kill one that no longer poses a threat. And I think that gave us tremendous power internationally, nationally, and our moral purity and authority. So I think it would be a grave mistake to kill terrorists that are subdued and no longer pose a threat. I think that would be a grave mistake, and it should not be encouraged, and it should not be we should not be apologetic about it. I think people that killed terrorists that no longer posed a threat and they were subdued, it's a crime. And I think halakhically it is something that should not be done. And in the modern world, sometimes halakha is intertwined with norms and ethical values, which we should not disregard. I think it gave Israel tremendous moral authority in the world, knowing that an Israeli soldier would not hurt an enemy that is subdued and no longer is a threat to life. So I think encouraging and standing up for those norms is a mistake. I think we should stick to our tradition that Israeli soldiers would not hurt a subdued enemy. Was there another question that I did not respond to?
Okay, this actually is just a statement, but it's a question. It's a subject, I guess. Pinyon Shvuyim, the consequence of releasing terrorist prisoners. I guess the question is obvious, but what do you think about exchange?
Once again, I did write an extensive tshuva about it. But I think many other questions in our modern climate, not always, our sources always come back to the Gemara and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. But not in all cases are they applicable. And sometimes we need to take into account the reality of our modern day and age. And I think it is entirely within the authority of the military and political establishment to decide what are the terms of exchanging terrorists for our soldiers. I could share my political opinions with you, but I don't think that you necessarily would be very interested in hearing my political views. I don't think that is the reason you all came together tonight. And I think I'm standing here as a Pesach and not as an individual that has political opinions, just like probably each and every one of you has his opinions. But I think it is firmly within the authority of the leadership of the country at any given time to decide what are the limits, what are the perimeters, and to what extent will we be forthcoming in releasing terrorists to save our own and to bring our children back home. Because there are so many considerations. On one hand, yes, history proved, and this is a tragic fact, but it is a fact. But we have learned that releasing terrorists ultimately will bring about tragic events. And history proves that many of those terrorists that were released went back to be engaged in terror. And some of them are hardened by years in prison, and far more dangerous than they were before. On the other hand, every Israeli soldier serving out there and putting his life on the line needs to be assured that the country will do everything within its power to try to bring him back home. And that is also part of our unique pride as a Jewish state that will go to the extremes to bring our children back home. So I do think it is firmly within the authority of the political establishment and the military establishment to set the rules and the price we are willing to pay to bring our children back home.
introduce a question. Do you want to give a 5 minute or 3 minute thing, or is it just a one?
Okay, so the last question would be about organ donation, and I want to make a general comment regarding organ donations. For many years, the Haredi community was attacked as being somewhat insensitive to the need of the ill and the desperate, and we don't donate organs. And it was painful to hear those attacks. Yes, we are God-fearing Jews that totally adhere to the Shulchan Aruch. And we are bound by the Shulchan Aruch. And if our Gedolim feel that brain death would not be sufficient to enable the removal of organs, then we won't do that. However, there's a recent trend in Haredi communities about kidney donations. And I just want to tell you that we top the list in the entire world. Nowhere in the world is there a higher rate of live donors of kidneys as in the Haredi community, primarily in America, but in Israel recently as well. No other community in the world are there so many people that are willing to donate kidneys, and many of them to people they don't know. And I am asked approximately at least once a week by people who consider donating a kidney, and not to family members, but to people they don't even know. And to me, this is the ultimate mesiras nefesh. I can think of nothing more noble. Just the day before coming here, I was approached by a person that strongly wants to donate a kidney. But his wife argues, you have 5 children, you have a family to care for, and she's not comfortable with it. And I said, you should not do this unless your wife is totally there together with you, because your kidney belongs to her as well. You know the famous story of Rabbi Levine, who accompanied his wife to the doctor, and he told the doctor that her leg hurts us. So your kidneys belong not only to you, your kidneys belong to you and your wife and your children, and they have to be part of this decision, totally part of this decision. Don't pressure them and don't try to impose your will. But I am extremely inspired about the number of people in our communities, in the Frum community, that are interested in donating kidneys to save people they might never even know. And this proves something about who we are, and it fills me with pride. So, are we for or against organ donations? I think this proves we are totally for saving lives within the context of halachic permissibility. So if we're dealing with organs that must be removed from a body before cardiac arrest, well, most of the Gedolim feel that that is something that is not halachically permissible, and we don't do that. If we're dealing with the possibility of donating organs to save lives totally within the context of halacha, so I'm proud to say we top the list in the entire world, and no other community, neither Christian nor Muslim nor Jewish nor secular, anywhere in the world has a greater number of living kidney donors than the Frum communities. So this is something we should be very proud of. It was a pleasure to be here with you tonight, and I wish you all Hatzlocha and Nachas and Gesundheit.